Toppy Bowles. And that's it, chopped away by Bailey down towards the fine third man boundary. Australia have won in a canter here. They've won with more than 25 overs to spare. A crushing victory. England came into the match with hope after two wins to get back in the series. But that's been snuffed out by a ruthless Australia performance. Good with the ball, and they just knocked them off with the bat. And home by 8 wickets, and they won the series 3-2.
Here we all are again on the ABC Grandstand Ashes podcast for one final time after a long and arduous tour of the British Isles. Jeff Lemon joining you through this final episode, and with me, my grandstand colleague, Adam Collins. The Age newspaper out of Melbourne has sent us Jesse Hogan, and over in the final chair, BBC sport journalist Stefan Schemmelt. Welcome, gentlemen. And here we are looking back over, firstly, a one-day international series that occasionally thrilled, occasionally spilled, and in the end was probably one of the damper squibs in the decider, but at least we got to a decider, Adam.
I thought it was quite a good series. It could have been one of those series after a World Cup had concluded where, you know, lacking in context, you already resolved who the world champion is a couple of months ago. But due to England's revival in the white ball form of the game and Australia coming into this with a radically different squad to what they had in the World Cup, it proved to be quite a good little contest. It was punctuated by, you know, Stephen Finn's catch diving at mid-wicket, Jason Roy out in the deep, Glenn Maxwell's catch, an excellent fielding. You know, Alex Hales wearing a walrus mask at one stage. We'll never forget that. And of course, some, you know, standout performances from, I think, Pat Cummins and James Taylor, who both have really now established themselves as principal weapons in their respective sides.
I imagine there'd be kids around England who'd be having nightmares about that for years. You're walking down a dark alley and Alex Hales leaps out at you with the head of a heaving, steaming walrus.
I think his batting is probably giving a few people nightmares as well, isn't it? Not least himself. It's certainly going to give Jason Roy nightmares. His sort of performance as a quasi-umpire, Alex Hales. yesterday, the ball missing leg stump by, what, a foot maybe? Mm. A good few inches, nothing. Probably standing at the non-striker's end thinking, am I going to get some runs? Am I going to get on a tour? Nothing doing.
I share Michael Vaughan's view on this. Alex Hales was standing about 10 metres away from the stumps when he was adjudicating that at the non-striker's end. He's nowhere near close enough to the umpire to make a credible judgment on that. It was an extraordinary bit of the fact that he was the one that called it off, called the whole challenge off. Two league before dismissals in three balls should have been overturned.
But how tough is it to expect a non-striker to also be an umpire? I mean, you've got to sit there and judge a run. You've got to be, you know, thinking about your own innings. You've got to be sort of watching the bowling and working out what you're going to attack and defend, what the field's doing. And then you're just supposed to casually umpire the game at the same time.
Mind you, what Michael Vaughan said, I'm surprised that I hadn't really heard that enunciated publicly so before. Like, you know, it should just be obvious now in the age of DRS, and not just for limited overs, but for tests as well, to be able to do that. But yeah, you're right, Jeff. The demands are ever growing, but it's unfortunately for Alex Hales, it's something that he probably doesn't really need at the moment, considering we arrived here saying, hearing all these raps about how he's got to be the guy they force into the test team straight away because of his weight of runs and his potential to, you know, look $1 million. Whereas from everything I saw, whether it be the T20s and also through the one day, is Jason Roy was the one, especially with that driving off the pads, that really looked like, you know, he was the one that was capable of more. And you've got to say, the first time I noticed Jason Roy was last year when he was one of the guys that KP mentioned as one of the guys I got to get into the team. And based on what I've seen firsthand from his first appearance, I've got to give that one to Team KP.
A lot of similarities, I think, between Hales and Joe Burns for Australia. Both started this limited over series an absolute lock to open for their country. Now, of course, we'll go to the Bangladesh squad later about Joe Burns, but their primacy is at top of the order. It has definitely been questioned based on white ball form.
And the thing is now with Alex Hales, you're saying he was an absolute lock to open at the top of the one-day side. Now when Joe Root comes back into England's best one-day team, you're almost looking at Alex Hales could be the man to go, because basically the answer in every question to English cricket now is Moeen Ali can do it. So the chances are they could push him to open up the batting with Jason Roy, Taylor at 3, Root at 4, and all of a sudden there isn't a space for Alex Hales.
Well, he's looked terrific opening the batting before Moeen, and you almost felt he was wasted in this series. He was coming in sometimes with 3 or 4 overs left. You know, he's a stroke maker, he's not a slogger. You want him out there with more overs to face, don't you?
And with all this chat that Moeen could potentially open in the test side in the UAE, actually it's opening in limited overs cricket that he's been more used to in the county game. That's what he's done for Worcestershire. He's batted at the top of the order. And so, yeah, you're absolutely spot on that he would probably be more suited to opening the batting in limited overs cricket than he would be in anything else.
So do you reckon was Alex Hales maybe sabotaging Jason Roy with that with that call, just to make sure he doesn't get any more runs?
Jeff. We'll leave it with you for that one.
Well, he's made plenty in the series. You know, Roy made a couple of 60s and a couple of 30s in the series, so he was piling them up. One more big score.
Roy was very impressive. I thought out of all the England players, he was the one that looked the most at ease at the crease and was able to drive on the up at will down the ground. And he unfortunately just threw it away with two fairly clumsy dismissals to short cover in the third and fourth fixture. If not for those two, they would have had to have strongly considered him for the UAE, I think.
I love that theory. It's just an extra layer of intrigue, isn't it? Right, Jason Roy's getting a few runs. If one hits him on the pads and he asks me, I think you're out, mate. You're going to have to go.
But, I mean, look, two in three balls. You've got a standing umpire who's given two pretty rank decisions. One was a massive inside edge and the other one was missing leg stump by about a yard, and he's given them both out. Now, if you're the striker, you've got to think, surely I can't be that lucky twice. You've overturned the first one. You're not going to challenge the second one in three balls, are you?
And that's exactly why Roy didn't challenge the second one. He thought, I've got away with one here. If I challenge it again, I might just look a little bit selfish. Just going back to the sort of the point of the non-striker as an umpire, you can't have it both ways, can you? Because you can't, as the man who's out there as the non-striker, eventually you're going to be the striker. What's the first thing that you do when the finger goes up? You go and talk to your mate down the other end. Can you imagine a situation the next time when the striker walks down to the non-striker? What do you think, mate? Whoa, I'm having nothing to do with this because I'm going to get blamed if it goes wrong.
Yeah, I'm not paid to umpire, mate. It's not my job. You know, I don't know. What do you think? It was one of those games where right from that first point you felt like it wasn't going to be England's day. You know, there was that bit of bad luck in there. And then suddenly they're 3 for 22. Owen Morgan gets bashed in the head, has to go off hurt with a concussion. It was ugly scenes and just kind of one of those subsidence innings where, you know, they rolled for not much more than 100.
And when you get the new ball destroyer being not Pat Cummins but actually John Hastings, who, for, you know, 2 days earlier thought his one-day career would have finished with being blasted over his head for six by David Willey. And I actually thought it was a very big call but a wise call to when it came to the selection for that last test. Australia brought back Mitch Stark because it was the decider, even though they wanted to rest him. In terms of seniority and certainly in expectations, James Pattinson is and will be much higher than John Hastings, having been, and he was in the initial squad. But then when it came to the I think I'm very big on complementary bowlers for a match, and I thought if you looked at Pat Cummins being in there and Mitch Stark, Hastings offered a much better third seeming alternative to James Pattinson, and he really proved that. And I think, realistically, he knows that this could be his last international performance, but at least he's going to be able to look back at the end of this and say, rather than finishing it with getting blasted over my head by for six, I'm able to go and say, I got 3 for 21 in a crucial game to get Australia to a series victory.
In 10 overs as well to go for 21 in 10, but I thought giving him the new ball was really important as well.
Yeah, I think it was as well. That they really probably kept him on account of the fact that he made 34 not out in quick time in that match at Leeds. I'm not sure whether it was the bowling that kept him in the squad, although I do agree with you, Jesse, that he does complement the two quicks much better. But just imagine the week he's had. The previous Sunday, he was called up to this squad. He would have thought, if they were picking 15 bowlers to have played in this one-day series back in May when they were originally considering the red ball and the white ball squads, he may not have been in the first 15 bowlers selected.
He wouldn't have. Absolutely wouldn't have. I mean, Clint McKay may have been in there. You know,
yeah.
He
was
well
just so far away from the frame. Obviously, he did really well for Durham in the 50-over comp through the summer here and forced his way in when they needed some people at short notice. But he was clearly shocked when he was called up in the first instance. Then to get a game, then to get retained after being smashed at Leeds, then to win the series. I mean, this will be a week of cricket he never forgets.
Do you think he has a future? Is this an absolute one-off? Will they pick him again, or was it just that he happened to be in the very right place at the very right time?
Oh, I think it's the latter. I'd be surprised if he was retained beyond here, especially when you consider the fact that James Faulkner's in the wings, having been ineligible to play in this series. But as Jess said, if this is the last time he plays for Australia, it's a fine send-off.
It's a lovely little story there for the Duke, John Wayne Hastings. And he does that in the Big Bash a lot. He just comes in at number 8 or 9 and sends balls over the fence.
There was a theory as well that Durham would actually have been quite pleased that John Hastings got this call up, because if he hadn't played any international cricket, he might have been struggling for a work permit. So
is
they
that
were absolutely. That's just a theory.
Yeah, okay.
But they will be absolutely delighted that he's played these couple of one-dayers.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's only 29. Let's say that he sticks around for another couple of years for Durham. 2017 Champions Trophy, another couple of injuries. Fancy a game, John?
It could happen. I mean, he looks about 48, but he comes in, he's just kind of all bulk and muscle and brute power, but then he's got that bit of subtlety, that ball that he nicked off Taylor with, you know, just did enough.
He's almost a bowler that Australia just need to keep around for one-day tours of England. Are we in England? John, fancy a game? Come on.
Well, John's about, he saves you an airfare. Yeah. He's already over there, you know. Just get him to pop in the cab, give him a cab charge.
Makes good afternoon teas. He's your perfect cricketer. I think that he actually has a lot of similarities to Peter Siddle in the red ball game in terms of complementing the attack. Siddle, when he was out of favour about 12 to 18 months ago. It was all about the fact that his pace was down. It was always the drumbeat about, is he quick enough? He came back from county cricket last year and said, I've picked up a yard. Went to the UAE and it was evident that he hadn't. And that's where he fell out of favour with the coaching panel, or with the selecting panel rather, when Josh Hazlewood was picked in front of him. And it took him 5 tests over here to reinforce that pace isn't everything. And when he went to the Oval, he was, of course, the most influential player in that test match. So, you know, I think there is a bit of a cultural shift maybe going on within Australian cricket, or ever so subtly, that raw pace isn't everything.
It's going to be hard to get that, a cultural shift like that under Darren Lehman, though, because that's been his mantra the whole time. And I think we're only barely going to see a tweak to this sort of pace is king argument. You're not going to, I think, see a really big change in it from Darren Lehman. He's very big on the idea that he wants his bowlers bowling 140 plus. And I think the advantage of Hazlewood for him is that he thinks he can generally nudge about 140 and still, putting this tour aside, be able to put it exactly where he wants to be. So I think that's where Nathan Coulter-Nile is probably another one who could fill that role. I think that's where it's going to be. But I guess the thing about Siddle, though, even when he went back to shield level, he dominated and he was bowling very quick. I know you don't get the speed guns there, but I watched him a couple of times and he certainly wasn't just ringing it in being down there at the second level last time. He was really putting in.
But he's making a virtue now, Siddle, in his discourse with the media about the fact that he is now a bowler who has a bigger bag of tricks. And he believes he'll never bowl 145 again, but he's got a greater arsenal to draw from. He's a more mature bowler, etc. It's like he's trying to educate Lehman and co that there is utility in having a bowler who doesn't steam in as quick as the others. So, you know, I look forward to seeing how that plays out, especially in the UAE, because the temptation may be, and again, we'll come to this later, not the UAE, Bangladesh rather, the temptation will be to go with raw pace then again, I'm sure, but whether, you know, Siddle can mount the case through the tour game that he should be in the side, it'll be fascinating.
I think the other thing that was interesting about this series is for people that have watched Australian cricket for a long time, you've seen the three of the big emerging pacemen have been Pat Cummins, Mitch Stark and James Pattinson. We never saw a chance for them to play together in the same match, never had been able to be fit together for the same time until this tour. They finally put all three of them together. We wondered about whether it would work, all three in the same attack. You have to say one-day cricket is a bit different to Test cricket, but gee, on first glance, it doesn't really work with the three of them. Certainly, based on the way that James Pattinson in his first international career for a while, his pace was good, but just for one-day internationals wise, there were just too many half volleys, too many juicy balls with no swing that were too easily dispatched to the boundary.
Yeah, I wonder where this leaves Pattinson in his discussion. Yeah, I feel as though
it's early days for him. Surely, I mean, he's had a long comeback trail. He's played a couple of one-days. He's been smashed in both of them.
Yes and no. It is a long way back. And yeah, he's only played half a dozen games for Australia and with the white ball in the last 3 years. And yeah, he's broke down a couple of times with hamstrings and back now. But as far as the pecking order, he is 25, and there is a very substantial bulk of fast bowlers there. And I just wonder whether he'll need to do something fairly extraordinary to get ahead of Cummins and Stark now, whereas he was ahead of them by an absolute country mile 2 years ago. Whether that's still the case in 2 years from now, we'll have to see.
And it points to something that Trevor Bayliss said in his sort of post-match media yesterday. He was very keen to sort of stress the point that this young England team, some will make it, some won't. And, you know, a few years ago, you looked at Pattinson and Cummins and Stark, you thought, oh, they'll come through. And for various reasons, things just don't work out for some people. It could be injuries, it could be a loss of form. And like you say, Pattinson's 25 now. Who's coming through next? There might be someone else.
You are on the ABC Grandstand Ashes podcast with Jeff Lemon, Adam Collins, Jesse Hogan and Stefan Schemmelt. And we're conducting our post-mortem of the series that's been, but it's also time to look ahead. Australia have just announced their test squad for Bangladesh, 2 test matches coming up, and a few surprises among those named, Jesse.
Andrew Fecherty, waking up to the news of Andrew Fecherty being in the test squad was absolutely stunning news. I remember seeing him for the first time about 5 years ago when he played his first game for Victoria, bowled with good pace and broke his foot in a one-day game all of a sudden, then was given a contract by Tasmania. Sort of been beavering away down in there, did enough to, I think, be Shield Player of the Year or close to it a couple of years ago. Went on the A-Tour of Bangladesh, India just recently, but almost similarly to the Hastings sort of situation. If I was going down, you know, in the past week trying to work out who were the bowlers they were going to take to Bangladesh, I really probably wouldn't have had Fecherty in the top 10 that I would expect. And that's probably more shame on me and sort of shame on him because his performances have really justified it. And I think really what he's been selected for is to fill that sort of Peter Siddle role. I think it'll be either or in the 11, it'll be Siddle or Fekete, someone that they know that can bowl at a decent sort of pace but sort of keep it tight, but is also old enough and has a sort of strong enough body to be able to be bowled into the ground and then keep coming back the next day and not worrying about what they're going to do workload-wise.
Yeah, he's 30 years old, only played 18 first-class games, and he's so new to the game, really, that his Cricinfo profile photo looks like it was taken on a webcam. there's no pro shot in the team shirt or anything. But, you know, he was on that A tour and he seemed to excel when he was given that opportunity.
Yeah, and I think those A-tours are becoming increasingly instructive as to what they're going to do with the senior squad. Over the years, it used to be that third fast bowler could be. It's been picked from the sky many times. Like I think of when Cook played for Australia, Nicholson, Muller. There's been a whole raft of people get that Guernsey. Even when Bird came in a couple of years ago, which of course is a bowler who made an Ashes tour, got a test in England in 2013. He was considered to be, you know, ready to roll in this exact role we're talking about right now after Siddle.
John Hastings 3 years ago in South Africa in Perth.
Of course, yeah, indeed. Yeah, we've had a raft of them come through. Clint Mackay even in Perth a couple of years before that against the West Indies. So, you know, this isn't unusual to have a specky come from the sky for the third quick. Whether they actually require three quicks in Bangladesh, it'll yet to be seen.
Plenty of talking points in this squad. I'll just run you through a few of them really quickly. Adam Voges as vice-captain is an interesting one, very inexperienced player. We've essentially got four opening batsmen with Bancroft, Joe Burns, Usman Khawaja and Sean Marsh. Could all be at the top of the order, depending who gets picked. Stephen O'Keefe's made the tour ahead of Agar, the left-arm spinner who got that one test in the UAE. People have been clamouring for him for years, but he hasn't had many opportunities. Glenn Maxwell's in there, the big show. Going to get some Maxwell ball happening in bangers.
Yes.
Look, it's all on. Two Marsh brothers, only a couple of Mitchells. But look, there's plenty to talk about in this squad.
And Jason Gillespie was right, wasn't he? Dad's army came to England, and that squad has been decimated. And just looking at that, you know, from an English point of view, looking at that list of names, you know, you're thinking of the squad that destroyed England 18 months ago. That is now gone. And from an English point of view, is there much to be afraid of there for 2 years' time?
Well, exactly. I mean, you've got five of the core of that 13-14 team are all out, you know, from the bowling and the batting.
I liked one fact that was in the Sunday newspapers that said that Steve Smith, with 25 catches, now has more catches than anyone in the Australian first 11, which seems it's an interesting point. It was an interesting reference point or something, an ankier argument on how inexperienced it really is. It's not been around very long. For me, it's the most fascinating thing will now be what Steve Smith does with himself. You know, averaging over 70 at number three, three big hundreds in the space of seven test matches, and increasingly looking like he'll drop himself to four in favour of Usman Khawaja, who we talked about the A tour. Khawaja was captaining that and batting at the top of the order, ostensibly to replace Rogers. So I'm not sure whether the thinking's overly clear there.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's what's going to happen. I think probably we come first test in Chittagong, we're going to see Sean Marsh opening alongside Joe Burns with Usman Khawaja at number three and Steve Smith moving down to number four. I think it's been a long time coming for Usman Khawaja. I think he's really earned his position there. I think the one that's really going to divide a lot of people, probably a lot of people in this room as well, is the idea of Sean Marsh getting back another go. Having seen he had an awful tour, only played that sole test obviously in the Ashes, and silly dismissals in both innings, actually didn't learn anything. For a guy who's as old as he is, he actually should know better than actually to follow a ball like that in conditions like that. I think the reason he's actually been given a reprieve here, he's probably a beneficiary of Warner not being there and needing some semblance of experience, but also the idea that some of his best performances have come in those sort of conditions. Sri Lanka on debut got a big century, then also made 80-odd in the second test of that series. The thing is about Sean Marsh, and I know that I'm in the minority here, is that when he's good, I think he's better than just about anyone in Australia. But his worst is just about worse than anyone in Australia too in his position.
Well, that's how he forced his way back into the side in England. He had those two tour game hundreds. And yeah, they don't count for an awful lot in terms of, you know, fairly second-rate attacks. But all the same, he looks like he was in absolute top nick. That 100 he made at Kent on the first day of the tour was as classy a 100 as you'll see. And I gather, I wasn't at Derby, but I gather it was the same there. So he does find a way of bashing the door down. He's obviously very popular with the top brass. But where my concern with Marsh getting elevated to the top of the order here is it ruins the team balance. It'll force Voges to five. Where does Maxwell fit there? If Maxwell's six and Marsh is seven, that means Neville's eight and we're not playing two spinners anymore. Now, I wonder whether having, you know, slotting him in at the top, it might, you know, fortify the top of the order somewhat if he's having a good day. But if not, you're eliminating the ability to play two frontline spinners. And who would come to Bangladesh and not play two frontline spinners?
Is this a horses for courses thing for Bangladesh, or is there any sort of long-term planning here?
Well, you'd hope that Maxwell... I think most people would agree now that Maxwell has established himself well enough at first-class level, one of only a handful of Australian first-class cricketers who average over 40, I should add, to now be playing red ball cricket and white ball cricket at every opportunity. And in order to achieve that, you need to find a place to put him. Now, is it five or six? Probably has to be five.
I'd say he's justified the hype in this last year. The way he performed in the World Cup, where he was, you know, really the player of that tournament, he produced so many dynamic performances, and then he's backed that up in this one day series here, where he's just changed games off his own bat. You know, with his catching, even with his bowling, you just have to get someone with that much talent amongst the side, surely.
And I agree with that, and I agree that he's probably going to bat at number five. So that means you've got space for four batsmen. If Steve Smith wants to bat at four, which we seem to think that he does, so where does that leave Voges, who's now your vice-captain?
Well, exactly. You can't leave him out, really.
Mm. Well, that's right. It does create a crunch.
Does Voges bat six and sort of take up a hussy role, but then where do you leave Mitch Marsh?
Well, I'm of the view that Smith should bat three. You know, your best bat, I know it's a bit old-fashioned, but I think your best batsman bats three. And Smith has established himself there already in a short space of time. He struggled in the Midlands, he struggled in Wales, but everywhere else he's gone, he's batted well. He's run a form. It's hard to question what he's done as number three or indeed as number four over the last couple of years. And yeah, I grant you that Usman Khawaja has batted number three for the vast bulk of his professional career, but I see no reason why he can't make the rise to opening the batting and, you know, have a second career as opener for team balance, really.
Another question is, though, do you actually need to play two spinners? Because Bangladesh haven't been preparing spin tracks lately. They've been winning with pace. They've been winning with seam bowling. They've won three ODI series on the trot. They beat Pakistan, they beat South Africa, and they beat India in home conditions. But they've done it on seaming tracks because they've got this young seam attack who they finally put together and who are bowling teams out.
That's why I think the composition of this squad was really important when they went over there to be able to have enough fast bowlers there that could actually suit a three-man pace attack, and also probably two and a half spinners in terms of Nathan Lyon, Steve O'Keefe and Glenn Maxwell in terms of if the conditions suited that. So I think really a lot of it's going to come down to pitch scouting before that first and second test.
I also think that this is the first of three subcontinent tours in the next 18 months, and they're all really important. I think they've got to win here, then build up to Sri Lanka next winter and ultimately to India, which is kind of the holy grail for Australian cricket. Winning away in India is the hardest tour, the hardest road trip there is. So if you're going to get used to playing two spinners, let's get used to doing it now in light of the fact that we're certainly going to be doing it in Sri Lanka and definitely in India. And if that's the case, you can't get test matches into players overnight. You can't magically make them appear in their quick info columns. You need to have them playing test cricket. And if Steve O'Keefe's the guy they're going to go with for those three tours, I feel like it's just as useful playing him on account of the fact that he'll be more experienced for the next test and the one after that and the one after that. So I grant that that there might be a case for the conditions might require a third seamer or a second seamer and an all-rounder, but I think there might be some long-term benefit in getting the two spinners out there anyway.
Is the Bangladesh thing and playing at the subcontinent, is that a slight red herring in the fact that are Maxwell and Marsh always going to be in the best 11? So there are questions about balance, and is there an option for Neville to go as low as number 8?
Well, he's a much better batsman than number 8. You know, that's the thing. He bats top 4 or 5 in New South Wales. He could easily play as a specialist bat.
But this is a question that sort of faced England over the summer with Moeen Ali coming in as low as number 8. They've just figured out that they've got their best combination of batsmen and bowlers. If you've got Maxwell and Marsh in your top 5 or probably 6 anyway, do you still need 4 frontline bowlers?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, do they actually do enough with the bowling to really make up a spot? And I think Mitch Marsh is on the way. You know, I've previously not rated his bowling. I think I described his fifer in the World Cup as the worst ever taken. He just sort of plonked it down the other end and got lucky. But during this series and in the West Indies as well, he's really come on. He's added pace, he's added swing, he's added seam, and he's actually taking wickets now, which he went a very long time without taking international wickets at the start of his career. Now he's in amongst them.
Yeah, I agree with you. Usually the idea that two half bowlers doesn't make a full bowler, I tend to agree with. But with Mitchell Marsh, he's more than that now. He's a legitimate seam bowler at international level who does move the ball and does take wickets. He's shown that at both the red and white ball level this summer.
I think the interesting one too with the bowling that they've actually chosen for Bangladesh is you mentioned we've only got a couple of Mitchells in the squad. I do question which Mitchell they've taken. They've taken Mitch Stark, they've put him in the squad, not taken Mitch Johnson. But as part of that, they've admitted that Mitch Stark has bone spurs again in that troublesome ankle of his. He's needing painkilling injections to get through it at the moment. They're hoping that he'll just play through this, be able to get through the home summer and then the World 2020. And I imagine after that is when they'll probably try and rest him. I would think a better idea would be to rest him now and actually get him right for the try and get him as close to possible, close as right as possible as for the home summer and play Mitch Johnson. I think from what we saw through the Ashes, I think Mitch Stark has earned the right to overtake Mitch Johnson as the preferred strike bowler and as the first choice strike bowler.
Well,
most important bowler. And as part of that, I think Mitch Johnson I think Australia is better off rather than saving Mitch Johnson for the home summer, actually getting him to Bangladesh as someone that you know can come here, could go to Bangladesh, bowl 145 plus, really unsettle a lot of batsmen. And also because of his age and his physical profile, he's someone you know that is going to be able to, even as part of a two-man pace attack, he's going to be able to bowl his four over spells, probably three or four of them a day, and actually back up. I think it actually would have made a lot more sense had they taken Mitch Johnson to Bangladesh rather than Mitch Stark.
He's also had a few weeks off that Mitchell Stark didn't have, having gone home after the Test series.
Yeah, and Stark finds himself in that situation with, well, Warner not so much now because of his injury, and Steve Smith, where they're playing 19 months consecutive cricket, really, with a couple of weeks now to go home and rest. But really, it's 19 months on the spin because they're three format internationals and IPL players. Now, whether in the long run, whether players like Steve Smith and Mitchell Stark have to forego their IPL commitments in order to be fresher for national duty, I think that's a question and a debate we need to have. But I tend to agree, Jess, that having Stark come into this tour when he already looks exhausted. I mean, in this one day series, he all but admitted himself that he was spent. Sending him to Bangladesh in 2 weeks, it may not work out.
You are on the ABC Grandstand Ashes podcast as we take it home. Jeff Lemon with you, joined by Jesse Hogan, Stefan Schemmelt and Adam Collins. Let's talk England, Stefan. Over the course of the summer, they seem to have just had a lot of fun. I mean, they didn't quite seal the one-day series, but they actually seemed to be really enjoying playing cricket for most of the time they were out there, which is very new, given how absolutely miserable they were at the World Cup.
And that's certainly refreshing to see from the one-day game. Spectators, even players, media, when it came round to the limited over stuff, it was a shrug of the shoulders. It was, this is almost just schedule filling between the test matches. This is something that we have to do. Whereas in the New Zealand series, and certainly through this series, there's been a genuine excitement to watch one-day cricket. There was an excitement for a decider yesterday. There was an excitement to see the way that England play. How long that continues for, I guess a lot will depend on results. But yeah, you're right. There is a certain refreshing attitude towards the England one-day game, both from the players and from the people watching it.
We saw that particularly from Morgan, I think. He played with a real freedom and joy. He had a bit of time off, he had a break, came back into that T20 at Cardiff and just went absolutely bunter on the bowling there. And then he'd carried that through. I mean, he made an absolute pile of runs until he copped that hit to the head.
I think there's something to do with picking the right players for the one-day team as well. For how long have we seen Alistair Cook and Ian Bell plodding along at the top of the order, fresh from a test series, or not fresh from a test series, as the case may be? Stuart Broad, Jimmy Anderson, so many overs in their legs, not at their best. All of a sudden, we've seen players, limited over specialists, picked for this team. The likes of Jason Roy, Alex Hales hasn't had the best series, but he is a limited over specialist. James Taylor has shown us what he can do. David Willey looks like a real find with the ball. Okay, Rhys Topley didn't have the best debut yesterday, but he's a decent limited overs bowler. You haven't seen Sam Billings. He's going to be a good cricketer. England have finally picked limited over specialist as a team who plays the most test cricket in the world. Surely moving towards limited over specialist has got to be a good thing, and that's been reflected over the 10 one-days of this summer.
And I mean, they have enough cricketers to do that, really, don't they? I mean, there's so much limited overs cricket played in England domestically. You think, well, why not pick the best of that talent pool and get them into a national setup?
Sort of goes back, I know, with her sort of talking about 20 or so years ago now, but back in Australia, I remember at the time when they actually first decided to split the test and one-day teams, and it was almost seen as heresy.
The captaincy as well. Well, how can you have a different captain for Australia? Yeah.
Whereas now it just seems completely obvious. It seems crazy to actually go the other way and just expect because someone has incumbency in the test side that they're actually better suited to that. I think it's just another reflection about how we're much better suiting the players to the format. I think T20 was sort of at the vanguard of that, and now we've actually come around for the format in the middle one day has realised that that should be in the same vein.
Yeah, and white ball, limited overs cricket's often been a good guy who has the steel to go and play test cricket as well. I mean, James Taylor, as an idea, he's played a couple of tests, sure, but you'd have to think, and Stefan, I'll take your view on this, whether he's the sort of player who could go to the UAE and do well immediately with the red ball as well. He's composed, he isn't a thrasher, he seems to have all the bits in the right places.
I think limited overs cricket as a view to succeeding in test level is the right way to go. I don't think necessary success in test cricket translates down into the one-day game.
Well put.
And James Taylor, if he goes to the UAE, I would imagine that he would do very, very well. I can see that the theory that he is probably Ian Bell's natural successor at number three. If we think that Ian Bell has got a limited shelf life now in the England test side, Taylor is probably the next cab off the rank, probably competing with Gary Balance. And just on the subject of sort of white ball to red ball cricket, how much test cricket England do play mean that their test regulars never get the chance to play white ball cricket domestically. We looked at this during the World Cup, and I think Stuart Broad had played two domestic white ball games of any form over the last previous 2 years. These guys are either playing test cricket or they're being rested, which means when they come into the limited overs game, they've got to learn it at international level, and it just doesn't work.
It's amazing, really, to think about it that way. And I mean, after the 13-14 whitewash, one of the saddest sights I've ever seen in sport was Alistair Cook having to captain that seven-match ODI series. And he just looked, every day, he looked like someone had just shot his dog in front of him. You know, he did not want to be there. He was exhausted. He wanted to go home. And he had to keep saying, oh, no, I'm really passionate about this contest and really just keen to get over to Perth and play another match. It was torture. I mean, let the guy go. So they've done that now. You know, he's free. He's a helium balloon floating off into the blue sky, and that's a lovely thing for him. I think he'll be very relieved.
And when he was sacked as one day captain in December, one of the major theories was he will thank England for this later. He will particularly thank England for this, the selectors, the management, if he's holding the Ashes urn at the Oval in August. And lo and behold, look what happened.
Precisely. So they're on that right path, but they've got test matches to come in the Emirates, which is a hard tour, as we found out when Australia went there last November.
I think we mentioned before about the importance of Mitch Marsh and the way he's emerged with the ball throughout this series. I think one of the best things for me is the emergence of Ben Stokes with the ball throughout here. I think even though Stuart Broad had that amazing performance at Trent Bridge, my two most thrilling performances throughout the Ashes were Ben Stokes with the ball at Trent Bridge and Steve Finn at Edgbaston. I thought those two were really performances that will reverberate for a long time. Finn, there's been big raps in him. You know, we first saw him in Australia in the 10-11 Ashes series. At that stage, we knew there was potential, but there was always the boundary ball each over. And obviously, by the time they next came to Australia in 13-14, he was unselectable. He was sent home early just because there'd been that much tinkering done with his action. He was so devoid of confidence. He was going into the nets and bowling the ball on each side of the net. That was how bad it got. It was really great to see him back bowling with real fire and hostility. That's what I sort of found at Edgbaston. And Ben Stokes, like, from an outsider, I couldn't believe he wasn't in the World Cup squad. I know that he'd had a very tough time of it in subcontinent conditions in Sri Lanka. I still would have had him there. I know we didn't see the best of him with the ball in the one-day series, but the way he went in the tests, the way he was able to swing it both ways at Trent Bridge was just absolutely extraordinary and really bodes well for what he can do for England for a long time.
Definitely share that view about Stokes. To be a credible all-rounder, you need to be able to win the game with ball and bat. That's how you warrant your spot in the side, how you earn your money. And we always kind of knew Stokes could do it with the bat, but it was at Trent Bridge, I think, when once and for all it was resolved that he can be a match winner with the ball. That was a clinic of swing bowling, not just in terms of placement, but the way he was able to hoop it around corners and have it trained on the stumps. That's exactly what you need from a swing bowler, and especially when you consider that Jimmy Anderson won't be around forever as your principal swing weapon at the moment. Stokes won't ever open the bowling for England, I wouldn't imagine, but he'll be a very useful ally to Steve Finn when he's leading the attack ultimately.
Well, you don't want a player like that opening the bowling. You hold him back as a weapon and then you unleash him at the right time.
I think from number six downwards, England's future looks very exciting. You know, it's just shuffling that pack into the right order to make sure that everyone is doing the right job. You know, where does Stokes bat? Where does Moeen Ali bat? What's going on with Joss Butler? But we know that these guys have got a long test future, probably as match winners, particularly Stokes and Butler. Could Stokes end up bowling first change? He may well do. Stuart Broad looks to be re-energised. Eventually, we're going to need a replacement for James Anderson, but Mark Wood and Steve Finn look like they could, you know, they'll fill that void, and there's people coming through too. So once England just nail that sort of opening partner for Alistair Cook, what's going to happen with Ian Bell? The future looks pretty good.
Well, precisely. You've got Joe Root, who sort of wants to stay at four, but you know he's a tremendous talent. And I agree with you that someone like Taylor could be a lifeline there, or you know something to patch over that gap at three at least for the time being. But look, they've got this test series coming up. Are you confident or wary or?
Wary, I think, is an excellent way to describe it. The last time England went to the UAE on a wave of optimism, they were the best side in the world, the world ranking, top of the world rankings, and they got smashed 3-0. So we know, I almost think that the minute the UAE is cricket's last frontier at the moment, we talk about India being the holy grail for the Australian team. Well, England, the last time they went to India, they won. India does seem to be almost an easier place to play at the moment than the UAE. Pakistan's record there is phenomenal. They've not lost since they started playing at home to the UAE. So wary is an excellent way of putting it. And then obviously they go to South Africa and who knows what could happen there.
Which is an incredible record considering, you know, Pakistan's playing away at home at this neutral venue and they've made it a fortress.
Oh, Pakistan are a group of five teams in the world rankings between second and sixth who could all conceivably leapfrog into that second spot and challenge for number one and challenge South Africa. That was inconceivable a couple of years ago. Pakistan has somehow turned that into a fortress down at the UAE, and admittedly New Zealand did very well there last year, but it'll be fascinating to see how they proceed in the next couple of years. And this England on a high going over there, having just knocked over Australia, that'll be a great early test as to whether they've got the goods to go long term.
Misbah has done a tremendous job leading that side. I think he's someone we have a great deal of admiration for here on the podcast. Adam and I have waxed lyrical about Misbah Ul-Haq plenty of times.
He's like Yoda, isn't he? He's almost like the godfather of Pakistani cricket at this moment. What a fantastic job that man has done. If you think when he took over that side, how low they were and where they are now. And he's still not appreciated probably the way he should be in Pakistan. He's spoken about that himself. But what a fantastic captain. Probably won't be around for too much longer. He's admitted that himself. But he's done such a fantastic job for the Pakistan team.
He's more than a captain. He's been their best batsman, or more or less their best batsman for 3 years now. And he's been like a legitimate statesman as well about the way he talks to the game so articulately and so forcefully. And he's someone who will leave an enormous hole in Pakistan cricket when he finally does give it away.
And he's been an architect, really, you know, coming in when after the spot-fixing scandal and having to rebuild that team from basically rubble at the time.
And they've got no idea who's going to take over the test side either. They're genuinely concerned. Speaking to people at the World Cup, the likes of Wazim Akram, Ramiz Rajot, they don't know who's going to lead the test side. They're genuinely worried about who could take over.
Maybe Azhar Ali, he's taken over the one-day captaincy, as I understand it. But you know, and he's been a pretty solid partner for Misbah through some of those partnerships. But in any case, we'll see what happens in that test series to come in the Emirates and Australia's tour to Bangladesh. But that's probably enough from us today at the ABC Grandstand Ashes podcast. It's enough for the series two, this tour of the British Isles comes to an end. My thanks to our guests today, BBC Sports' Stefan Schemmelt, The Age newspaper's Jesse Hogan. As always, Adam Collins and I have been very pleased to bring you all of this cricket chat, and hopefully we'll catch up with you again on the next edition, whenever that may be. In the meantime, thanks for joining us through this series.